Hello, I'm Dominic Fazioli. This is number 0604, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0604. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Art Bell, author of Constant Comedy, How I Started Comedy Central and Lost My Sense of Humor. It's a memoir about the comedy cable network he started 30 years ago. Where did the subtitle of the book come from?
I was new to the comedy business. I didn't know very much about it. And that first year of Comedy Channel, which became Comedy Central, that first year was so difficult. You know, the channel almost died several times. And I really wondered if we were going to get through the year. The subtitle itself came from something that Michael Fuchs, who was the chairman of HBO at the time, said. He said, it took a Comedy Channel to get me to lose my sense of humor.
Martha Bolton, co-author of Dear Bob, Bob Hope's wartime correspondence with the GIs of World War II.
The relationship between Bob and the GIs, it was not your ordinary fan-celebrity relationship. They were buddies. They were brothers. He often referred to them as, you know, his sons and daughters. And they would joke around. Their letters were sometimes their escape from what they were dealing with. And they would just write to their buddy. And just like, you know, guys do, you know, you joke around with your best friend. And that's what they would do. And so there's a lot of laugh, but there's also, you know, the ones that just pull at your heart.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. What does Peter think, really think, of Governor Andrew Cuomo?
He's a bum. Is that precise enough? He's a terrible person, and this has nothing to do with Democrats, Republicans. He's a thug. He's run the state into bankruptcy. The state is collapsing. It's one of the worst of the two worst states, the other one being California. He's ruined it. As a matter of fact, even Ted Kennedy once referred to the family as mafia family. He wasn't too popular with the rest of the Democrats, so they think he's kind of very pushy and shovey.
And we got lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0604 was reporter and video journalist Dominic Fazioli, who runs the news site East End Montreal. And Dominic and I worked together for many years when I was a reporter and anchor at Global News, and he was one of our star reporters at Global News. You can check out his website, East End Montreal. You'll find the link by going to the number of this particular show on our website, which he just mentioned. See how it all comes full circle? Thank you very much, Dominic, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A 41-year-old man in Great Britain is suing his parents in a bid to force them to pay him maintenance for life. Despite being a trained lawyer and having a degree from Oxford University, Fayez Siddiqui claims he is completely dependent on his wealthy parents. For 20 years, his Dubai-based parents have let him live rent-free in a $1 million flat that they own near London's Hyde Park. They also help to cover other bills. But now that his parents want to cut him off, Siddiqui claims that his upbringing has made him vulnerable and that cutting him off financially would be a violation of his human rights. A case against his parents was rejected last year by a top family court judge. It is now gone to the Court of Appeal. Aren't you beginning to wonder if his parents got their money's worth by paying for him to get his Oxford law degree? How fast do you think the parents are moving to get better lawyers to write him completely out of their wills? Authorities in Camden County, Missouri, arrested 43-year-old Lee Ann Bauman, a prominent Lake of the Ozarks real estate agent and self-described cheer mom, on March the 4th, for plotting to kill her former mother-in-law. Prosecutors say Bauman offered to pay $1,500 to a person in St. Louis who contacted the Missouri Highway Patrol and then turned informant, recording Bauman's request that the hit look like an accident, and later saying that she's a Christian, but she could ask for forgiveness later. Don't you just love pious types who use their religion as an etch-a-sketch to absolve them of their sins? Anyway, Bauman also texted her daughter saying, "Your grandmother will die." She is being held without bond in the Camden County Jail. At press time, she still doesn't have a lawyer. Too bad she isn't in the UK, because that lawyer from the last story is looking for work. Yeah. Detectives investigating recent thefts of catalytic converters from vehicles in Pasco, Washington, went to the mobile home of 30-year-old Dustin Allen Bushnell in nearby Burbank with a search warrant on February 26 and not only found converters, but also discovered a 400-pound playground slide that had been removed from a city park in December. The slide had been repainted and mounted to a bunk bed in the home. Bushnell was arrested for possession of stolen property for the slide. No charges were filed for the converters yet. Well, this is just a slippery slope of crime, isn't it? Just how do you go unnoticed when you steal a 400-pound playground slide? How could this be a crime that nobody sees? Anybody check to see if there's a teeter-totter in the bathroom? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a judge ordered a psychological evaluation to help determine the competency of a Florida man charged with having sexual contact with a pair of large stuffed animals at a Target store. Judge Kathy Ann McKeighton appointed a psychologist to do a checkup from the neck up on 22-year-old Cody Meter, who has been charged with criminal mischief and exposure of sexual organs. A Target loss prevention officer told police that he watched as Meter took a stuffed unicorn to the children's bedding department, where he exposed himself and took the unicorn and placed it against his penis and began a sexual motion. Meter, wearing shorts and a Star Wars t-shirt, then went to the front of the store and picked up an Olaf snowman stuffed animal and began having sex with that. According to the Target worker's witness statement, the subject finished having sex with the stuffed animal and ejaculated on it and then wiped it off. Upon being read his rights, Meter admitted to doing, quote, stupid stuff, unquote. Wow. Curious to know how that psych eval is going to go. Do you think the doctor will ask him, show me on the doll where you touched the doll? I'm also curious about his childhood bedroom and what that looked like. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Comedy Central is about to celebrate its 30th anniversary, and Art Bell is also celebrating the channel that he created. His memoir came out in the fall, and it's called Constant Comedy: How I Started Comedy Central and Lost My Sense of Humor. Art joins us via Skype from Greenwich, Connecticut. Hi, Art.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. I love the subtitle of the book, How I Started Comedy Central and Lost My Sense of Humor. I worked for a long time for Just for Laughs. That's pretty much right.
Well, you know what? I was new to the comedy business. I didn't know very much about it. And that first year of Comedy Channel, which became Comedy Central, that first year was so difficult. We, you know, the channel almost died several times. And I really wondered if we were going to get through the year. And the subtitle itself came from something that Michael Fuchs, who was the chairman of HBO at the time, said. He said, it took a Comedy Channel to get me to lose my sense of humor. And, man, I wanted people to understand that Comedy Central didn't emerge fully formed and totally successful the minute it launched. It was hard.
Is it one of those situations where, especially now that you have a memoir and you're looking back at it, is it one of those situations where if I knew then what I know now, maybe I wouldn't have even tried this?
No, I can't say that. I am so pleased to be sitting here with you at basically the 30th anniversary of something that I started and helped build that has been, you know, kind of a monolithic thing in the comedy business. A cultural icon, has done a lot of good for a lot of people, provided a lot of happiness. You know, it didn't kill me. It was hard, and it was a great experience, and I had a lot of fun. I would do it all over again just to make sure there was a comedy network in the world.
Now, you didn't have a comedy background to start with, so how did this idea come up in the first place, especially without having the background in comedy that, you know, some people might think you'd need to start a comedy channel like this?
Well, the short answer is I was a comedy nerd. I was a comedy fan from the time I was 8 years old. I watched comedy on television. I listened to the comedy albums, all the comedy albums, Carlin, Klein, all those guys, and did some comedy writing, satirical writing in high school and college, a little bit of performing. But it was really when I got to business school that I ended up writing what was basically the comedy, musical comedy review there for the business school students. And I reminded myself how much I loved comedy. So when I came out of business school, I said, hey, I want to go into the television business. And you know what? Where's the comedy network? I love comedy. There's a news network. There's a sports network. There's a music network. Where is the comedy network? So I sort of made it my mission. Well, I wouldn't say that, not my mission, but I just kept thinking about what a comedy network would look like and how cool it would be. And when I got the chance, I talked to people about it.
Was it your vision that you thought maybe a comedy channel could be to comedy what an MTV was to music?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, the beginning of Comedy Channel at HBO, which is what started it all, we expected and hoped to go with a lot of short form comedy programming. And by that, I mean not only, you know, short films and everything, the comedy films that you could find, but also clips from movies, comedy clips from movies, comedy clips of stand-up performances, whatever short form we could find. And we could get those on a promotional basis because the studios were anxious to have us promote their films because they had everything out in video. So if we promoted an old film, you know, with a 3-minute clip, they said, oh, okay, maybe somebody will go rent the thing and we'll make some more money. But that plan fell apart.
Now, was it a love-hate relationship with the comics themselves? And the reason why I ask that is, as you know, on a music station, you could play a music video of some group, and then that group can tour, and people want to hear the hits. But the thing about comedy is, you put a lot of comedy material up on television, and suddenly those comics have to come up with new material because audiences don't want to hear the same thing they can get the clips of all the time, unlike what they do with music.
Peter, you said, you know, that's like 10,000 questions in one. But let me say this. When we launched and we started putting stand-up comedy on the channel, and we started running those clips over and over because we didn't have a lot of stand-up comedy. We didn't have a lot of any programming at the beginning. Some of the comics who saw that said, oh, my gosh, they're playing my stuff to death. I'm really in trouble here. And then we'd say, okay, you don't want us to play your stuff to death? And they'd say, well, wait a second. I didn't say we didn't want you to play. I didn't want you to play it. Of course I want you to play it because I need the exposure. So they were kind of like not even sure how to deal with all this. The other thing is, when you know, it's interesting that you say that people did not want to hear the comedy hits. I saw Seinfeld perform in 1991 and people, or 92, and people were screaming from the audience, do the sock bit. And so it's not entirely true that they didn't want to hear some of those famous bits. But for the most part, you're right. I mean, the comedians were worried that we were running their material into the ground and they'd have to come up with new stuff.
So, again, the 30th anniversary is the reason why you've written this book. But now you're that far removed from when you first started this. Was it a sense of pride? Are there things that you perhaps forgot about, or the struggles that you realized when you first started this, that you look back at it and you know, kind of pat yourself on the back and say, yeah, I did a pretty damn good job here?
You know what? I look back and I say I did a job. I was pretty new to the television business. I was a young executive. I didn't have a lot of experience in anything. I had worked for three years as an economist in Washington, D.C. That was my background before I went back to business school.
Well, that's the heart of the comedy world right there.
We had a lot of laughs. I was smart in those days, and all went to hell when I started working in comedy. But, you know, I say I did a job. I feel like I did a pretty good job, given that I didn't know anything about the business. And mostly what I brought to it was a way to put together a comedy network, a way to show people that a comedy network was not only needed, but that it could be financially successful, because I did work out how to do the finances. That's how I sold it in. And finally, here's what I pat myself on the back for: persistence and vision. I mean, I did not give up. There were so many things that went wrong before we launched and in that first year. And listen, at the end of the first year, they shut us down. They shut our competitor down, Ha, which was launched by MTV Networks. And they said, Art, okay, you guys are going to merge. I know it's two completely different kinds of a comedy network, but you guys will figure it out. And they merged us with another channel. Suddenly, we're starting from scratch with a whole different cast of people, a whole different set of programming that we had to figure out. The good news is we all wanted a comedy network in the world. And I was really hell-bent on making sure that that merger would work and there would be a comedy network in the world. And that's what became Comedy Central.
What do you feel is the most or the biggest part of your legacy in relationship to what Comedy Central was and is?
What we started doing in the early 90s that I think has really made an impact is that we started covering the news. Now, I'm not talking about The Daily Show. This is before The Daily Show. We covered the State of the Union address in 1992. And the idea was to cover it and have comedians commenting on what was going on. And we were going to do the whole thing live. Al Franken was the first comedian to do that. And it was a spectacular moment for the channel. It was a time when suddenly everybody looked up, all the press, who had not been particularly kind before then, looked up and said, wow, this comedy network's really going to do something. And it was very successful. And after that, we covered the Democratic convention and the Republican convention. And we went on to do a lot of news coverage. Jon Stewart was involved in that. That was before the Daily Show showed up. And then when the Daily Show finally got going, we all know what happened there. We had a lot of younger people getting their news primarily from Jon Stewart and the Daily Show. Now Trevor Noah, who's terrific. But my point is, that's a great legacy, to bring the news to people who otherwise did not care what was happening in the world.
Was that a melding of your two worlds? You said you worked in Washington. You were a big fan of comedy. Was that just putting the two together like a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup?
Well, I'd have to say no, because if you were going to put together what I was doing, you'd be putting econometric models of the energy system in the United States together with comedy. I don't think that would have gone very well. I think the idea of doing news was about the immediacy of comedy. You know, the idea that you could improvise in a way about what was happening in the world and make it funny. I mean, listen. We weren't the first guys to discover politics in comedy. I mean, Mort Saul was doing that in the early 60s and very well. But we were the first guys to do it in the way we did it, which is watch us watch the world and have a laugh. And that's what we were doing.
Your book, Constant Comedy, who would you say your primary audience is for the book? Someone who is a big fan of comedy in general, or someone who is looking for the nuts and bolts of how a particular business could start?
Well, I really wrote it as a way to describe my experience in the business world and in the comedy world, and to tell people how difficult something like this was. I find that young people who want to get into the television business are really loving this. They really enjoy the book. And I'm also finding people who are a little bit nostalgic, like you, you know, remember when comedy got started and want to find out what happened. In short, I think I'm writing it for comedy nerds, people who just love comedy for comedy's sake and want to see how it works.
The book is called Constant Comedy, How I Started Comedy Central and Lost My Sense of Humor. Art, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
Art Bell, author of Constant Comedy, How I Started Comedy Central and Lost My Sense of Humor. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0604, and you'll find the link to Art's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at Patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Viewer discretion is advised. But then again, why are you staring at a radio program?
And still to come on the program, Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, will share a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. We'll also hear from Martha Bolton, who is the co-author of Dear Bob, Bob Hope's wartime correspondence with the GIs of World War II. And we do have an idiot of the day coming your way and much more in Stuff File News here on the Stuff File program, which is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get back to the stuff, shall we? Sarasota County Sheriff's Office deputies closed off a road in Sarasota, Florida after a serious crash shortly before 11 p.m., a BMW drove over the traffic cones and sped through the scene at an estimated 100 miles per hour. The deputies had to dive out of the way to avoid being hit by the car, and six of them said they very nearly were hit by the car, which was dragging a traffic cone. Naturally, at least one deputy jumped into their patrol car and gave pursuit, and the driver pulled over. Deputies couldn't help but notice that 24-year-old Joshua Y. Gockman had a bag of powder in plain view that later tested positive for cocaine, as well as a rolled-up $1 bill, a marijuana grinder, and a hash oil vaporizer. Gockman was wearing an undershirt, boxer shorts, and one sock. When asked why he was speeding, Gockman said he had business at the Ritz-Carlton. He was arrested on several counts of aggravated assault on a police officer, drug and paraphernalia possession, and DUI. He was lodged in the county jail. Well, the county jail isn't quite the Ritz, but they do offer accommodations. No turndown service, though. Staff at a resort hotel in Deerfield Beach, Florida, told two guests that they had to wear masks at the resort. The men allegedly told the staff that they were exempt, with one pointing to a badge on his belt. "I'm a U.S. Marshal, and I can have you arrested if you force me to wear a mask," he told the employee. Another employee who watched the exchange called the police, telling them her cousin is a U.S. Marshal and knew marshals wouldn't act like that. An officer, and a real on-duty U.S. Marshal, responded, and 53-year-old Walter Wayne Brown, Jr., and 81-year-old Gary Brummett were arrested, charged with impersonating a federal officer, and lodged into the county jail pending bond hearings. Wow, huddled into a county jail. Bet they're wearing masks now, in an environment where it's highly recommended. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a man was left bleeding from his penis and unable to have sex for a month after he said his high-tech, internet-connected chastity belt was taken over by greedy hackers. Sam Summers, the unfortunate owner of a cellmate digital chastity belt, ended up paying the hackers a $1,000 ransom to free his manhood from the device, only to have the unscrupulous cyber pirates demand even more money. Fed up with the shakedown, Summers and his partner took matters into their own hands and employed brute force and a sturdy pair of bolt cutters to crack the chastity belt, leaving the man with a cut on his member. Summers was not the only cellmate user to have fallen victim to hackers. Other men reported similar incidents, including one who said that he received a text message from an anonymous number that declared, "Your blank is mine now." And blank, by the way, is another word for rooster. Just saying. The cellmate, produced by a Chinese firm that has the slogan, "Love Hurts," is a cover that clamps on the base of the male genitals with a hardened steel ring and does not have a physical key or manual override. The locking mechanism is controlled with a smartphone app via Bluetooth, marketed as both an anti-cheating and a submission sex play device. It retails for $169 on the company's website. Never mind getting trapped in this thing because it's either a fun sex toy or an urgent need to avoid having sex. What about if you just have to pee? And again, whenever I hear stories about some new device that, frankly, the world really doesn't need, my mind often wanders to an R&D boardroom where a bunch of people are spitballing ideas for their next big hit. I'm thinking, who in the room came up with this idea? And do we need to call security? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? For 5 decades, Bob Hope traveled the world performing before American and Allied troops, putting on morale-boosting USO shows. Well, there's a new book out called Dear Bob, Bob Hope's Wartime Correspondence with the GIs of World War II. The book is written by Martha Bolton, along with Bob Hope's daughter, Linda Hope. Martha Bolton joins us on the line right now from Nashville. Hi, Martha.
Hi. I'm thrilled to be on your show and talk about the new book.
We're thrilled to have you here. This is something people should know, that you worked with Bob Hope. You were a writer with Bob Hope for many years. The first woman staff writer for Bob Hope, as a matter of fact. And, of course, Linda Hope is Bob's daughter. So there's the connection. How did this book come together?
We were working on it back when Bob was alive. We had talked about it. Linda had grown up with the letters, and then we worked on a project where the letters came up, and I discovered them. So I talked with Bob and mentioned how I felt that it would make a really good book. And so he suggested I talk with Linda. We discussed it, had some meetings, and started working on it. You know, as what happens in Hollywood, you get onto other shows and projects. And so we, you know, the years passed, and then unfortunately Bob passed away. And then a few years ago, I got an email from her, and she said, "Do you want to get back on that project and finish the book?" And I said, "Absolutely." So by then, the letters were now up at the Library of Congress before they were at his house. So I went up to the Library of Congress and finished going through the letters and finding, selecting which ones. And then I passed the manuscript back and forth between me and Linda, and it was going to come out last year. We were hoping that it would, but it came out this year, which after last year is a time when we all need hope. So we like to think that Bob is still using his perfect timing. So I think the world is ready for a book like this that offers a lot of hope and laughter. But definitely hope.
I would also assume, just by the nature of the letters and the reasons why they were written in the first place, there's got to be a lot of hope, as you said, but there's got to be a lot of tears in just reading these correspondence, these personal correspondence of GIs.
There are, the tears will come, I guarantee you, because I've read and reread and reread these letters, and every single time there's certain ones that just choke me up. But there's also laughs. The relationship between Bob and the GIs, it was not your ordinary fan celebrity relationship. They were buddies. They were brothers. He often referred to them as his sons and daughters, and they would joke around. Their letters were sometimes their escape from what they were dealing with, and they would just right to their buddy, and just like, you know, guys do and girls do, you know, you joke around with your best friend, and that's what they would do. And so there's a lot of laughs, but there's also, you know, the ones that just pull at your heart. And there's also a lot of historical interest in it as well, because this is a firsthand account of what was going on.
You mentioned why it took so long for this book to become reality. Of course, Bob passed away in 2003, and he was 100 years old. And now, with more years since Bob's death, I would assume that less and less of any of the GIs who have written him are probably gone. So this is a definite piece of history. Have you had any reaction or response from people, either who might still be alive or the family of those who had written to Bob about this book?
You know, some have, as far as, you know, especially the Hollywood connection and whatnot that helped in the war. And there's letters from them, which is interesting. You know, you'd be reading through the letters, and then all of a sudden you'd find one from Mickey Rooney, or you know, different ones that you recognize the name, and it was pretty interesting. But that's the we wanted to get it out so that those that are still alive today could enjoy it. Plus, we're getting letters from and responses from people that they're, you know, they'll say their grandfather fought in a war or this or that, and so that the book is meaningful to them for that reason. And even people that may not have seen Bob Hope during World War II, they knew buddies that saw him. And so when he would come into a camp, it just would spread that spirit that he brought in, that spirit of home. It would go from that camp to the next camp to the next camp, because he got close to them, and it just spread. And that was the power that his humor and his heart had. And through the letters, that is what comes across, is we all know about Bob's career. We know about, you know, all the good that he has done for so many causes. But this book, along with the GI's letters, it shows the heart behind that relationship. And you understand it. You knew that they were close. Whenever Bob would interact with a veteran, you could see it. But this explains why. You just see his heart.
Well, I was about to ask. You, as I mentioned, were a writer with Bob. You wrote some of the military shows that he did. So just going back from your own recollection, what was the draw? What was the pull? How emotionally invested was Bob when he did those USO tours?
Oh, he was very emotionally invested. In fact, these letters, he could hardly read them without choking up or even talk about them. I mean, they just, you could tell when the subject would come up that there was a huge emotional impact on him with what these letters represented. It was real, and it lasted the whole 50 years. In fact, I think it grew. I think when he first appeared on March Field and did his first military performance, you know, it may have been at one level, but you can see through the war, in World War II for sure, you could see it growing, the depth of that relationship. And then not only did he do it then, but to keep it up. You know, he had volunteered to keep up the morale for World War II, but then he went on and on, and every war in that till the end of his life. And his last military show, he was 87 years old, and he's crawling in and out of helicopters, and he's going into, you know, near the battlefields, and it, you know, putting himself in harm's way at 87, when he could be cruising down to Rio and having the time of his life. He had done plenty in his life. He had given back plenty, but he kept it going. He had made a commitment in his heart to the GIs, and if they were going to be there, he was going to be there. He was no fan of war, but he was certainly steadfast in his support of the GIs that were laying it all on the line.
Well, what do you think grabbed him by the heart? And the reason why I ask that is I'm sure he had the greatest and most proper of reasons to start entertaining the troops. But it's one thing to say, you know, this is a great idea. I'm going to go and I'm going to entertain the troops. At what point, from either the first time he did it or sometime later, did it really become his life's work and he just could not stop doing this?
I would say, just from my own experience of reading the letters and his reaction to it and different things that he would comment on, I would say probably what really cemented it in his heart were those hospital visits and seeing the loss, seeing the great sacrifice, and then also realizing that he would perform and so many of the kids that he's performing for would be lost in battle soon thereafter. And that realization, just, you know, you can't not be moved by that. You can't not change by that. It's got to get in there into your heart. And I think it sure did. And there was one show that he did where something like 60% of the audience was lost in the next battle. And I mean, that keeps you up at night, you know?
Did he ever receive letters from family members of someone who may have seen his show and was later lost in battle?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. The moms, the dads, it's the letters would say, describe their son and whatnot. And then the next sentence is, I'm writing to tell you that he was killed in action. And the feeling that the connection was that since you saw him, since the last time I saw him, you saw him more recently. And so I just thought I should let you know. And it was that connection to their son or daughter that just meant something to them. And they would write Bob and tell him about, they would also, you know, tell him what they would describe their son or daughter and what their dreams were. And if they had a girlfriend waiting for them back home or whatever, they would just get into their life and just like you would a friend. And he was their friend. So they would share things that it was just okay to tell Bob Hope, you know. It meant an awful lot to them.
His letters, as you mentioned, ended up in the Library of Congress. Was that something he was aware was going to happen before he passed away? Or is that something that just naturally happened?
Well, it was talked about that he would have a museum. And there was plans made and different things. In fact, it was going to be in Florida, and there may have been other places that they had bounced back and forth. But what ended up happening, which is even better for the nation, is, you know, his artifacts were given to multiple museums and like the Library of Congress and, different areas that had some of them. So each one, you know, the World War II Museum has an exhibit, the Library of Congress, World Golf Hall of Fame. So there are these exhibits all around that people can go and experience what his life was about. He definitely wanted them on, you know, to go somewhere to where the American public could experience.
How do you think Bob would feel knowing that his letters ended up in the Library of Congress? And how do you think Bob would feel about this book?
Well, we started it when he was alive. I had talked with him about it. Linda had, you know, we'd met. And so it was all with his blessing. And he would be honored that they were in the Library of Congress. And they've done such a beautiful job of just handling such a mass of paper. So he would be pleased. And I like to think that he would, and Linda as well, we like to think that he would be very honored about the book.
Well, the title is Dear Bob, and you can take that so many ways. It's a touching recollection of the stories and the correspondence he received from GIs. Martha, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Martha Bolton, co-author along with Linda Hope of Dear Bob, Bob Hope's wartime correspondence with the GIs of World War II. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0604, and you'll find the link to Martha's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holden.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Latitude 47 degrees 14 minutes north. Longitude 84 degrees 39 minutes west. Location Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents the Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And from the still somewhat locked down New York City is the Gabby Cabby himself, Peter Franklin. Hello, sir.
Hello, hello, hello. Live from the streets of New York, where I think we're looking for another governor.
Ooh, we'll get to that in a moment. But let's talk about what is happening in the city of New York. We haven't chatted now for a couple of months, so it's now over a year that we've been dealing with the pandemic and a lockdown of some sorts. Are things starting to open up? You know, movie theaters, restaurants, schools, Broadway? What's happening?
Not really. I mean, they're trying to do it and they want to get it going. And after all, the strength of New York City is the clubs, the arenas, the museums, and all the touristy stuff, all the entertainment stuff. And it's just not working. It really isn't. For one thing, over a million people have left New York City. That's a lot of people to be bye-bye. So I don't know how it's all going to work out. Look, there's a lot of money at stake if you can get the city going again. So a lot of people are going to try hard, but I just don't know if it's going to be successful. Stay tuned to the Peter Anthony Holder Show.
Now, there's a recent issue of Harper's Bazaar, which had an article by one of my favorites. Fran Lebowitz was talking about her fear of eating in those restaurants where you have the outdoor pods that you can sit in. And the fear that she was talking about happened just last week. Someone plowed through some of those outdoor seating places in New York.
Yeah, but that's not so really unusual. I mean, it happens. It's funny for me to say it. It happens all the time, but it does. I mean, New York is famous for its outdoor, let's call it European-style dining and all of that. And since the tables are right on the road, so to speak, you're just asking for trouble. So it happens all the time. Frankly, they're just making a bigger deal out of it and kind of blaming it on the pandemic. Because, look, if you can't blame everything on the pandemic, what good is it?
It has been a little over 50 days since Donald Trump left the White House, but he didn't come back to the friendly confines of Trump Tower. He has fled to Florida and Mar-a-Lago. Do you all miss him at Trump Tower in New York?
A lot of people do. I mean, he was very much a part of New York City. He had a very, you could say, abrasive style, but that was Donald Trump. And so I think a lot of people do miss the action. Certainly a lot of people are talking about the fact that Biden and his administration is really kind of boring. The only thing that's going to spark everything up is that this is the week when most Americans are going to get about $2,400. Ooh, goody, goody, goody. Where is my check?
Okay, so let's get to the governor that you alluded to a few moments ago. We've talked about Governor Cuomo in the past. I know there is not a lot of love lost between you and basically his entire family. So I will unleash Peter Franklin. What do you have to say about the governor of New York?
He's a bum. Is that precise enough? He's a terrible person. And this has nothing to do with Democrat, Republican. He's a thug. He's run the state into bankruptcy. The state is collapsing. It's one of the worst of the two worst states, the other one being California. He groomed it. As a matter of fact, even Jack Kennedy, well, not so much Jack Kennedy, but Ted Kennedy, once referred to the family as mafia family. He wasn't too popular with the rest of the Democrats. So they think he's kind of very pushy and shovey. And this is the old saying, the chickens come home to roost. Every day that goes by, there's another example of some kind of mufky-fufky, which is just wrong, especially when you're running a state into the ground like he has.
In the past, you really haven't had a lot of nice things to say about your current mayor, and there is talk that maybe the current mayor will run for governor. How do you feel about that?
Well, it's not so much how I feel. It's most people feel that he's the worst mayor in the United States, just like the guy in California is the worst, and also the worst governor is of a New York State. These guys are bums, and everybody pussyfoots around. They don't want to say it. They're thugs. They're bums. They're terrible, terrible people. And that's how I feel about it, and most reasonable people feel about it. They're just not nice people. Did I say they're bums? Yes, I think I said that.
Okay, so let's be honest here. We're talking about one of the greatest cities in the world. It's certainly, if not the greatest city in the United States. And yet, from what you're saying, the greatest city in one of the greatest states can't seem to, in your estimation, elect people who are not bums. Why is that?
Well, the fact of the matter is that in the United States, most people don't vote. And it doesn't take many people to win an election. And it's controlled by the Democratic machines, Republican machine, and that type of thing. So you don't have that many people who vote, and that's why you could elect them. As a matter of fact, I'm almost sure that if Cuomo was running again, and if the mayor was running again, they'd probably be reelected, as bad as they are.
There is a possibility that could happen in both cases.
Absolutely.
Okay. So moving along from the politics of it all, I understand that the fine folks at Amazon are cutting down on toilet time at their New York facilities. What's this all about?
Yeah, you know, well, what it's all about is how much money do you need? Figure if you're a guy named Bezos and you own Amazon, lock, stock, and barrel, how much more money do you need that you got to start chiseling as to how many times a day employees can go to the bathroom? You figure, spring for some bucks, you know, maybe enhance it a little bit. But they haven't done it, and because of that, it really, really is a terrible situation where he is going to eke out every money that he can get from them.
Mm. And another story that was in the news in New York City, there apparently a landlord is being sued in a rape case?
The fact of the matter is that those are the strange aberrations that seem to happen, and that's what happened, that he's accused of doing that to one of his tenants and said to her in a way, either put out, or if you don't, we're in trouble.
But I noticed on your, at Gabby.com, you said, if you let your building staff have a key to your front door, you are nuts.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, for instance, when we lived in any number of apartments in New York, the landlord will say they want a key to your apartment, so if there's an emergency, they can get in. That's a very standard thing in a lot of apartment houses. I never would give the key under any circumstances. I think the first thing I would do would be to check the lock the minute I moved in.
So before we let you go, I just got to ask, how busy or how not busy are you since we were now reaching, quite frankly, a year into the basic pandemic and lockdown? Has it really put a crimp in your business style as far as...
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Peter, there's no business at all. As a matter of fact, I'm always have been a proponent of New York City. I would be the first person to say to you, if you were coming here, don't.
Wow. That's not good. You were always a great ambassador.
Not good for me.
You were always a great ambassador for New York City.
Yeah, well, that's what happens, Cookie.
Yikes. Well, I hope things turn around and that, you know, 2021 is a lot better. Well, it can't be worse than 2020, but is a lot better than even, say, 2019. Let's hope for a brighter future this year.
I do too. Take care. Bye-bye.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have a few more Stuff File news stories to get to before we get to our Idiot of the Day, so let's get right to it. Over the years, we've had many stories of people driving drunk. We've also had many stories involving high-speed police chases. But let's up the ante here and combine those two things. Also, let's make it an SUV filled with kids, and the cherry on top can be pulling a U-Haul. Pennsylvania State Police have charged Michael David Myers after he led troopers on a high-speed chase. Troopers say Myers faces charges of fleeing and eluding police, reckless endangerment, and DUI. Authorities say at around 11:30 a.m. a couple of Fridays ago, a trooper observed a gold GMC that was pulling a U-Haul trailer speeding along Interstate 80 westbound. According to the troopers, the vehicle also displayed several equipment violations. State police say the trooper attempted to stop the vehicle, resulting in a high-speed chase along the interstate, and troopers say Myers began swerving in and out of traffic before turning, traveling through the Lowe's parking lot and back onto Route 255, at which time the vehicle hit a curb and the U-Haul trailer became unhooked. He continued to swerve through traffic prior to striking a minivan. He then lost control and got the vehicle stuck on a curb. Troopers say that there were two adults and three children inside the SUV, but that they were not injured. Myers was taken into custody. Well, this sounds like a bad Chevy Chase movie. Wow. Boozed up, high-speed chases involving kids and a U-Haul. This is also the beginning of a joke where the punchline is the aristocrats. And Wang Dong had been lecturing for nearly 2 hours. He had not answered his phone. He had not let the comments from students on his Zoom call or the departure of some of the students distract him. Finally, he invited the students in the Living with Mathematics course that he was teaching at the National University of Singapore to ask questions. It may safely be assumed that he did not get any questions that reflected the details of his lecture, but he did get one useful piece of information. He had been on mute for pretty much the whole lecture. A clip of his reaction, it took him a moment to come to terms with what had happened, went viral. He told the students that he'd give the lecture again later. You know, I really want to meet the students who stayed and sat through his pantomime lecture. Those are students who are either very lonely or are so robotically conditioned to follow protocol. And by the way, let's hope that a Singapore teacher by the name of Wang Dong never has to be a substitute teacher in a North American middle school. Those students would eat him alive. Anyway, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
On May 9th, 50-year-old Eric Dion Warren was sentenced to federal prison in Lubbock, Texas, after pleading guilty to robbing a bank and using a BMW he was test driving as his getaway car. According to court documents, Warren drove to an AIM bank in Walworth on June 7th, 2019, handed the teller a note demanding $10,000 in small bills, and showed what appeared to be a handgun. The teller complied, and Warren headed back to the dealership where he pulled out $3,000 as a down payment on the car that he had been driving. As Warren finalized the deal, the dealership received a call about the bank robbery, and the connection was made. Warren was given the maximum sentence of 20 years. Now, Why? Oh, why? Would you think that using a test drive Beamer, a flashy car that most likely had dealer plates on it, as your bank robbery getaway car, then heading back to the dealer to put a deposit on said vehicle as if nothing had just happened would be a good idea? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0604. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0604. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including the podcast station, cyberstationusa.com, Verdant Square Radio, kdxradio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, truetalkradio.com, download it on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and CKHR in Hay River. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. We leave you with this deep environmental thought. If we don't do something about global warming soon, eventually there won't be any ice floes left to put our elders on.